just come through the new year, and it was the custom, at least in Western culture where you grew up, that when you have a new year celebration, we make resolutions, we set goals. And so the talk this evening is about setting goals, or whether you should set goals, and what goals, and how goals, and what should you do about goals. So, my New Year's resolution this year, I've just let everyone know in public, is to eat more. Now, the reason I've done this is because last year's resolution was to eat less, and it didn't work. So this year, I'm using reverse psychology and see if that would help. But it just shows you, just sometimes we make resolutions, and it is a habit, a custom. So whenever we have a transition, especially from one year to another year, we usually look forward and say, what do we want to do? What do we want to achieve? And how can we do that? And so many people, they do set goals. And so I wanted to talk about goal setting in terms of Buddhism. I know that sometimes we tell people, oh, Buddhism should set no goals at all. Live in the present moment. But look, if I always lived in the present moment, I'd still be in Serpentine today. It's only because I planned to come here that I managed to move from my meditation to the car and get in it, because I had a goal to get here this evening. You will find you do need some goals, but there are times when we don't have any goals. And sometimes the confusion with Buddhism, people think, oh, it's such a passive religion. It just sits there and does nothing, as if it's like some zombie. And of course, I mean, you've seen many monks and nuns over here in the many years, and monks and nuns are not zombies. They're actually very active. And we do sort of set goals. We have a time when we set no goals at all. So in this talk, I'm going to be telling about when you do set goals, and also the times when you set no goals at all, when you just rest in the moment, become peaceful, and the balance we have between those two activities. But first of all, if you are going to set goals in life, the first thing to do is to set reasonable goals. In other words, know what goals are worth setting. And don't aim too high. Because what happens if people set so many really high goals, which are completely unachievable? What happens is they get disappointed, they usually blame themselves and get into guilt, they get frustrated, and they become a mess. And when you become a mess, you're more problem to myself and all the other monks who come here by asking too many questions. So I want everyone to be happy, so I can be at peace. So you set reasonable goals, and don't get too high. And the reasonable goals, there should also be goals which are really useful. So sometimes when we set a goal, we have a plan of action. Do you really want to get there? Is that really what you really want in life? I was just telling somebody today that some people's goals are very well informed by ancient philosophy. When I was a student, I read Plato's Republic. Now, Plato was talking about his teacher, Socrates, and was saying some of the advice which Socrates gave him. And in ancient Greek mythology, they also had reincarnation, and their idea is going over the river Styx, where you completely lost contact with your life, and you went over to what was called the Elysian Fields, you know, some heaven realm where you rested for a while. And then when it was time for you to go back to work again, in other words, take another human rebirth, the interesting part of the way that Socrates described rebirth was everybody has a choice. What do you want to be reborn as? And he said, and this was the wonderful part of his little description, the part which I thought, wow, now this Socrates really knows what he's talking about. He had insight. He said the stupid people always choose to be wealthy and famous. So that's the last thing you want to be, wealthy and famous. Look at all the other wealthy people in this world, all the famous people in this world. Is that really what you want? So you go and check out whether that is a really reasonable thing to aspire to in this life. And he said that just being poor is equally sort of extreme. And even Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher, realized that the best niche in life is not to be too wealthy, not to be too poor, but in the middle somewhere. Not to be famous, but just to be well liked by your friends, but not to be too well known by other people. So you can understand why that's the case. So I don't know why people want to be film stars or models or rock stars and become famous. I don't know why anybody wants to become a famous monk even. Unfortunately, sometimes I am a famous monk. Somebody told me that I've got Facebook and it's about 1,500 plus people. I'd never seen it myself. I don't know what they're saying about me. But it does get a problem sometimes when you go traveling. You can't get any rest because people know you. And unfortunately, when they know you, come and ask you questions about all sorts of things. And one of the stories, one of the extremes, was when I was traveling back from Los Angeles. I've been on a teaching tour in Canada and the United States, and obviously many, many days, and very, very tired, and it's a long flight, and transiting in Singapore airport for about 2 hours. But of course, I go to Singapore regularly, and you've got many people who work for Singapore Airlines who can get access inside. So they were waiting for me at the gate, some disciples. And I thought, oh no, can I get a bit of peace and quiet? And so they started, took me down and gave me a cup of tea. But give me a cup of tea wasn't the real reason for meeting me. The real reason was they can ask questions about their meditation, questions about their kids, questions about Buddhism, questions about this. And gee, I've been doing this for such a long time. I just got really fed up. So how can I get out of this, I thought. And I thought, the only place I can get out of this is going to the toilet. So I told them I needed to go to the toilet. It wasn't really a lie. I wasn't desperate, but it was, I needed to go to the toilet, not to relieve myself of, relieve my bowel, but to relieve my ears. So I went to the toilet to relieve my ears. But unfortunately, those of you who have been in Singapore and been in the airport there know that all the toilets there have got toilet attendants. And as soon as I went into the men's toilets, the toilet attendant recognized me. Oh, you Ajahn Brahm. Oh no. And he started asking me questions about meditation. And so when you can't even go into a toilet to escape fame, then you realize it's not nice to be famous. At least when you're not well known, you can have some peace and quiet by yourself. So the goals you should really have in life, if you are going to set goals, don't try and be famous or trying to be wealthy, even like being wealthy. I know many wealthy people. And many wealthy people just are basically nutcases. They are just so paranoid and afraid of losing their wealth, of being workaholics. And of course, one of the extreme cases was this time when I went to bless a house here in Perth on the river, a big mansion. And when I went to bless this house, I needed to go to the toilet, another toilet story. But this time, when I asked to go to the toilet, she said, well, it's a bit difficult to give you directions. So she drew a map for me. The house was so big, you had to have actually a map how to go from the room I was in to go to the toilet. And it was a long way. But nevertheless, when I came back and just did a blessing for her, afterwards I asked, this is a big house, how many of you live in here? And that's when she said, only me. And I was really shocked. I've seen this many times. She lived in this huge mansion by the river, alone. I said, why can't your relations and friends come in here? He said, I'm always scared of relations coming, because they always ask for money. And friends too. They're so afraid that she's one of the most loneliest people I've ever met. I thought, wow, who wants so much wealth that it separates you from other people? And I've said here also, for those of you contemplating building a house or changing your house, please get a smaller house. I'm saying this not just to save you money and save you lots of cleaning time, because haven't you noticed that big houses separate you from your loved ones? When everyone stays in their own room, and you can't even hear what's going on in your son's bedroom. There's so many empty spaces between you and them. Big houses means you don't have much social contact.
with your mother, father, with your children when you're growing up. And I remember living in a very, very small apartment. I had to share a room with my brother. And you're always bumping into your parents. You couldn't get away from them. What that really meant for me, I had to learn how to live with other people, to get on with them. Because you couldn't escape. You couldn't have your own personal space. And because you couldn't have your own personal space, you learned a huge amount of social skills. Give and take, forgiveness. You couldn't get into arguments because there's no way to hide, nowhere to hide. Especially when your brother was bigger than you. So you couldn't get into arguments. You couldn't have fights. You couldn't sort of have any problems because you had to live together in a confined space. And to this day, I always think that having a family in a small house gives a far greater social cohesion and love. So who wants to be rich? Sometimes the poor people, and you've noticed this, as long as they've got, you know, enough, I'm not talking about abject poverty, as long as you've got enough, you find that the richness of poor people is each other, the family, the social cohesion. I always wonder, why does that happen in poor families? They have this great social cohesion. It's because they're always on top of each other. They have to live together. They have to work together. So sometimes wealth is a curse for us. So if you have a New Year's resolution, please don't have a New Year's resolution to win the lottery or to, you know, get that great contract or to build the amazing house or to get your yacht or to have all these amazing holidays. Look, make the goal reasonable, something which will really make you peaceful and happy. So if you have a New Year's resolution, what sort of New Year's resolutions, you know, would you do as a Buddhist? Obviously, you know, to be, don't go saying I'm going to meditate more this year. This year I'm going to go to every meditation, going to meditate for half an hour every day. Don't do stupid things like that. Because what that's actually doing is missing the point. It's not meditating. It's what's meditating supposed to give you. Meditation is there to make you peaceful, to make you kind, to make you wise. So when we understand the purpose of doing these things, make the purpose of these things the goal. Not the means, but the purpose, what the end is. It's the same when people want money. What do you want money for? You want money for to have peace, enjoyment, comfort. Haven't you got that already? I know that I heard a great quote when I was in New Zealand. I forget who actually originated this quote. But they say that when you want more money, that stops you enjoying the amount of money you already have. That's actually a very great quote there, because when you want more, if you're so concerned about how you're going to get more, what you're going to do to get more, you can't actually rest right now and enjoy the benefits of all the hard work you've done so far. So what we really mean there, you've worked hard, you've got some money, now pause for a while to enjoy it, to get the fruit of what money's there for. But while you're working, enjoy your holidays, enjoy your peace, and don't keep thinking how I can make more. If you can do that, then you understand what the purpose of money is, and you make use of that money, you enjoy it, you make peace with it, you have a good time, rather than always wanting more, 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 more. Because every time you want more, you're always thinking of the future, you're not enjoying what you've already made, what you can enjoy right now. So many people are always wanting more, always wanting more, always wanting more. They're never enjoying what they're doing now. It's one of the little reflections which I teach when people do meditation retreats. Because sometimes we have meditation retreats, you know, here and overseas, which I teach. And one of the little exercises I give them is when you're eating. To eat one morsel at a time. Because many people, when they have their lunch or their dinner, and you can check this out this evening if you go back and have dinner or what you do tomorrow. Usually people, say you're eating with a spoon. You've already got one morsel in your mouth which you're chewing. And very often people have got another lump of food on their spoon waiting in line. There's also a third piece of food heaped up on the plate. And they're already thinking what they're going to eat next. So how can they really be enjoying what they're actually tasting now, when they're about two or three spoonfuls ahead of themselves? And you can find that's probably what you do. Try it next time you eat. See just how you eat. Are you really tasting, enjoying the food? Or are you planning what you're going to put in your mouth in two or three seconds from now? How can you enjoy this moment when you're planning what you're going to do next? So one of the important things of money is to be able to rest, to enjoy, so you can have a bit of peace and quiet and enjoy the fruits of what you've already earned. So there has to be a time when we work, and there has to be a time when we rest, and we just enjoy what we have, and understand what the purpose of these things is. It's the same with the purpose of meditation. What are you meditating for? And to get peaceful, to get kind. So I tell you, if you meditate here, and you go home and shout at your wife or get angry at your husband, and stop meditating, you're not understanding its purpose. Obviously, you're meditating in the wrong way. But if you're meditating here and you find you're an easier person to live with, a calmer person, a kinder person, then great, you're understanding the purpose of what we're doing this for. So it's understanding the purposes, the main purposes, and making them the goals in your life. A good example of this is some of you are in the caring professions. Maybe doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, counselors, or whatever. What is your goal, say, as a doctor or as a nurse? Sometimes people have the wrong goals in the medical profession, and they think their goal is to cure the people of their sickness. But if you go into such a profession wanting to cure other people, you will have a lot of suffering in life, simply because there are some people whose diseases are so bad, or they're just so ingrained, there's nothing you can do. That how many doctors have come to me and been so saddened, frustrated, that there's a tragic case of somebody they said they could not help, and they died. And I say, look, you're missing the point. It's not being a doctor, it's not about curing people, it's about caring for them. Because sometimes you can't cure a person. Sometimes it's a terminal disease, or a chronic disease which just keeps going on and will never get better. You can't cure them, but you can always care for them. And the real goal of such professions should be to care for the person. Care for the person first. That's the main objective. That's the main goal. Because that's something you can always do, and you will never get disappointed or frustrated if you go into that situation. Not trying to get them better, but to care for them. If you care for them, then cure becomes almost like a bonus, a byproduct. You're caring for them, doing their very best, but you don't demand that they're going to get healthy. That's not your main purpose, your main aim. It's the same with psychology or psychiatry. If you go in there and you want to sort of cure the people, again, it's just so frustrating and so tiresome, you just can't do it. But you can always care. That's something you can do with everybody, at any time. So remember the goal of these, that's why they call them the caring professions, not the curing professions, the caring professions. That's something you can always do. So when you understand what the goal is, you know, to care, not to cure, then you have a proper purpose, a goal which you can actually achieve, which means you don't get frustrated. One of the problems with setting goals is that you set these goals, they're not wise goals, so you go into medicine wanting to cure people, to find that magic sort of cure, to solve all the problems in the world, or to teach everybody to meditate and get into jhanas, become enlightened. That's not the goal of me being a teacher. If you set the wrong goals, again, you get frustrated, you get angry, you get upset, create more problems in life. And so the real goal should always be to care, to be kind. Something you can do which gives the best possible results. And even if a person does die, even if their mental illness doesn't improve, still, so their mind improves, they know that someone actually accepts them for who they are, they're kind to them, they care for them. And it's a huge positive impact you have on people. There may be somebody in your family, you'd hope maybe get over that problem. They hope maybe get over the financial problem, the social problem, maybe going to jail, they may go bankrupt, they may have some terrible cerebral palsy or schizophrenia. And instead of looking for the magical cure, that should not be our goal. Our goal is to care for that person as they are. something we can always do. Perhaps that was one of the things I learned as a student when I used to go to, I used to volunteer when I was a student at Cambridge every afternoon going to Forbon Hospital, which is a hospital for those who had mental disabilities, and especially working as a volunteer occupational therapist every afternoon, once a week, with Down syndrome kids. Like many people who go into that, my goal for doing that was to be a goody-goody. Basically, I had a friend who was a Christian. I was an avowed Buddhist, and we were in competition together. And when he said he was going to go do social work, I thought, if you're doing it as a Christian, I'd better do it as a Buddhist. Because Buddhists, we're more compassionate than you are. Nah, 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 nah. That sort of attitude I had as a student. So he decided to go, so I had to go as well, because he was a good friend. So we had great talks and arguments together. So I went there, and I went there for 2 years. And I enjoyed that so much. I looked forward to it. It wasn't any sacrifice. What I learned there is I did learn about emotional intelligence. Because Down syndrome kids, they weren't articulate with words, but they were incredibly articulate emotionally. Straight away they, come up to you and said, "You're looking sad today." And they're quite right. They were picked me up straight away. And so I learned from them how to sort of, how to communicate on another level than words, just feeling, emotional language. That's what I learned from the Down syndrome kids. And I know that from them, I learned also how to care, because there's no way that that condition would ever be alleviated. You never tried to find some magical cure so they could become so-called normal people, no matter what normal people is. So I accepted them as normal. They were part of life, part of the whole fabric of life. Not excluded, but accepted. When I did that, I realized I could actually care for them. And that was a wonderful thing you could do. And obviously, they showed immense care for me too. Sometimes brought me to tears. So understanding that you can always care for people gives another goal to life. Not curing, not changing them, but just caring for them. So your goal in life, you can't change your husband, you can't change your wife, you may be doing that for a long time, trying to change their bad behavior or their irritating parts of their life, but can't you care for them instead? It's a totally different goal, which gives totally different outcomes, outcomes which are actually positive. What about the goal of religious harmony in this world? How can you get religious harmony in this world? By converting everybody to being a Buddhist? It's impossible. And then which Buddhist? There's so many different types of Buddhism. So you can't do that, and that would be a stupid thing to do. So you know there's all these crazy fundamentalists who want to convert everybody to be just like them. They create so much disharmony, frustration, anger, and even violence in our world. So our job is not to change anybody. Really, the message of all religious leaders was not to try and change anybody. That wasn't their goal. Their goal was to care for each other. For the Buddhists, to care for the Muslims. For the Christians, to care for the Buddhists. For each one of us, to care for atheists, anybody. Isn't that what our religions are supposed to be able to do? Our goal is not to convert, but to care. And that's something we can always do. And I try and remember that, just, when you are talking with people from other religions. I remember this one of our monks who got caught traveling in a train from Newcastle all the way to London. And of course, a brown robe to a Christian fundamentalist is literally not a red rag, a brown rag to a bull. As soon as he saw this monk, this Christian fundamentalist came along, sat right next to him, and started haranguing him. Because in Christianity, if you can convert a Buddhist, that's actually extra merit points. Especially a monk. So they try to get the extra merit points by converting him, just haranguing him all along the journey. And this monk was very peaceful and just saying, "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah." And at the end of the journey, so everyone was looking at him, and the monk just said, "Well, even though I'm a Buddhist, I still love you." And put his arms around him and gave him a hug. And that completely silenced a Christian. Because what was the purpose of the Christianity? It was to show love. And the monk was showing more love than he was. And so he got to the heart of it, caring for each other, no matter what's happening. If you have that care, if make that your goal, it's something you can actually achieve. So we've set goals which are achievable and also useful. Because the usefulness of care, it does create harmony, it does create peace, and it stops many of the problems in our world today. I got a question from somebody some time ago who asked me, is there such a thing as like pure anger? In the sense that anger which is justified, which is right, now because it solves the problem and gets the thing settled. Is it okay in some circumstances to get angry at somebody because that might just shout at them or angry at them, then they behave afterwards? And I say absolutely not. There's no such thing as pure anger. Anger is always impure and negative. Because what are you trying to achieve by getting angry? If you really care for the other person, in other words, you want to help them change their way of speaking, their actions, the way they look at things, if that is really your goal, to help them change, then how's the best to actually achieve that? If they can change, that is. Sometimes they won't. As I said, you can always care for them even if they don't change. If they are going to change, how, if you were in that situation and someone got angry at you, would that really help? Would that really achieve anything? Sometimes, okay, you would behave just out of fear. And when they're not around, you revert back to your normal way of doing things. Because I remember that's what happened to me when I was at school. You know, you get punished if you broke the rules, and all that taught me was not to break the rules, or not to keep the rules. All it taught me was not to get caught next time. To be more sly, be more sneaky. That's all I ever learned from punishment. I thought I was stupid to get caught. So, I never learned anything from such sort of violence, or such shouting, or such anger. You learn much more from people who really care about you, and show that care. So instead of having pure anger at somebody, whether it's your husband, whether it's your people at work, to get more out of them, anger just diminishes what you really want to achieve. Gives maybe quick results, but temporary results, not real results. But if you care for somebody and show it, then you get results, because when people care for you, you want to help them back. That's always been the case in life. So instead of getting angry at a person, we can go other ways. The caring for another person, show that you appreciate them, show you care about them enough to say, well listen, this is really affecting me, it probably affects you too. If you talk to them in a kind way, they're more likely to listen and take it on board. I know that some people say that some people are just so have no conscience at all, are just so stubborn, they will not listen to anybody, they're like psychopathic in their tendencies, got no sense of right or wrong, completely self-centered, and just don't care about anybody else in the world. I thought that might be the case when I was young, but I had the privilege of going to visit some of the most horrendous characters in jails, in prisons. Both in UK, I've been in Changi prison a couple of times, and also here in Australia too. And one of the things I found, discovered, going to see these horrendous murderers and rapists and serial frauds and gangsters, one of the things I found in visiting these people was they did have a conscience. Only that many of them would not let on that they did feel sorry for what they did. I remember one telling me the first time, he said, look, I'll never tell this to any other prisoners, because we're not supposed to do this in jail, we're supposed to be the tough guys. We never did anything wrong. He said, really, everyone in this jail feels terrible about what they've did. Never an hour goes past when you don't regret and think if you'd only had a chance to do that moment again, you would never have done that terrible crime and hurt so many people. It was quite a revelation to me to see that those prisoners, yeah, they did have a conscience. And so if those prisoners, the murderers, the gangsters, the rapists, the people I've met, if they had a conscience, and they really felt bad about what they did, surely everybody else has a conscience. These are the worst of the worst. I've known they do have a conscience, known they do think about things, knowing that's part of having a human mind. You know, we can always work on that. So, by being kind, we don't have to get angry at another person, we can actually use the power of kindness. By being kind, it does not mean that you just allow the other person to continue on the way they've been doing all along. Just kindness opens up the door to criticism, to positive criticism, even in our monastic community. We have the rule of mutual admonition. But we have rules about this. So if I see any monk misbehaving or doing something wrong, as the abbot, as the teacher of a monastery, I just can't just say, oh, just let it be. But I can't also get angry. So what I have to do, I have to choose the right time and the place, number one, where you can approach that monk. Right time and place is important, because if you really care about another person enough, if you really tell them off in public, if you tell them off when they're tired, if they tell them off when they've had so much stress in their day, they're not going to listen at all. As I mentioned here many years ago, if you have a partner and it's something you really delicate you want to talk about, maybe criticize them for something they're not doing right or something which is irritating you, one of the best things to do is to take them out for an expensive dinner. A best restaurant where they like to eat. You know, and you sort of dress up nice, you know, if you're a husband, put on a nice suit, make it a really nice evening. And when you get to the final course, then you can tell your partner anything. They'll be so softened up. They say, oh yeah, I think you're right. And I do come home a bit late. Oh yeah, I'm right. My cooking is terrible. Or whatever. I don't know what it is. But when people are in a good mood and they're relaxed, it's very easy to talk to them. So if you've got something sensitive to talk to a person, take them to a good restaurant, take them to a movie, or take them to some sort of play, so they can have a good bit of enjoyment, and then you can actually hit them with what you need to hit them with. That's far more effective than getting angry at them. So first thing, choose the right time and place. Number two, just to make sure you got all the facts right, because I don't know how many times people have told each other off when it was not their fault. So get your facts right, first of all. That saves a lot of problems in marriages and also in offices and other, even in monasteries as well. And next thing is to make sure that you are speaking kindly. That's what the Buddha said. Say words which are gentle to the ear, which go to the heart, even though they're criticisms of the other person. If you say it kindly, the other person hears, wow, they still really care for me. But it is a mistake in my conduct. Yeah, I am a bit lazy when I'm working. I don't get up in time. I am nodding when I meditate. I'm doing this or doing that. So this is how we actually deal with problems with monks. We do it with kindness and care. And obviously they respond. Wow, that teacher really cares about me. And so, you know, you really want to sort of listen. Because everybody wants to develop and wants to grow. They want to be better. We all want to be better people. Sometimes we just want to know how to do it and not be told in such a way which frightens us or hurts us. So if you do it that way, you don't need anger. Other ways are very, very effective. And of course, and I've used these in very difficult and dangerous situations, and it always works. You don't need to get angry back. Even when the other person deserves it. The problem is with many people, some people do some terrible things. They really are selfish, they hurt others, but even so, anger is not justified because there is always another way, a much better way. And you know what happens when we still have anger, which is like verbal violence, it goes on to physical violence. You just have to look at all the wars which are happening right now in this world today. To understand just where anger gets us. We get angry at them, they get angry back, we have revenge, they hurt us, we hurt them more. We get what's happening in Palestine and Israel. Wars go on and on and on. And both sides have got righteous anger. If you ask the Israelis, their anger, yeah, this is pure anger, and they deserve it, these Hamas. You ask the Hamas, no, no, the Israelis deserve the rockets. Is there any solution there when we go in that direction? There has to be another solution. There is another solution. The other solution is for the Israelis to care about the Hamas and the Hamas to care about the Israelis. If we can get to that point, just people really care about each other, don't want to change each other, but care about them, then we might actually get somewhere in life. So the goal should not be to change or to get angry at another person, but just to care for them. And it's not just other people. What about yourself? Do you really want to change yourself and become a better person, a richer person, a healthier person? Or what do you want to do in your life this year? What is your goal for this year? How many people last year got so stressed out and tired you got sick? What are you trying to achieve? What about making your goal to care for yourself this year? It's a beautiful word, to care. What it really means, you care for your own health, happiness and well-being, your peace. Make that important. Because it is important that you are happy and peaceful. In fact, if you're happy and peaceful and content, you know, that's one of the best gifts you can give to other people. A happy person, a caring person, becomes a blessing to this world, according to the Buddha. Because you're actually showing other people what's possible and inspiring other people. You're being like a leader, an example. So if you're a happy person, you actually spread happiness. If you're an angry person, you spread anger. If you're a miserable person, you spread depression. If you're a happy person, again, you spread this lovely energy. So just who you are spreads such a lot in your society. You just have to think, how many people do you meet every day? Multiply it by 365, and that's how many people you have influenced over the last 12 months. And how have you influenced them? So if you're a peaceful, kind, happy person, if you cared enough about yourself to give yourself moments of peace and heaps of forgiveness and lots of kindness and care, then you'll find you are generating a huge benefit for other people. So to care for another person should never be at the expense of yourself. So understand that you count as well. If you haven't read this story before, it's one of the, I haven't said this for a long time now, the story of the seven monks meditating in a cave. This is in Opening the Door of Your Heart. Seven monks were meditating in a cave just on caring, on love. May all beings be happy and well. What we chant in Buddhism. May all beings be free from suffering. I open the door of my heart to all beings. So, in this cave were seven monks. There was the head monk, number one. The second monk was his best friend. Oh no, his brother, sorry. Brother was the second monk. The third monk was his best friend. And the fourth monk was his enemy. Now, even monks sometimes have personality clashes. You don't know what it is. Sometimes you just cannot get on. So the fourth monk in this group was the head monk's enemy. And the fifth monk was a very old monk. In fact, he was so advanced in years, he could die any time. Even actually that evening, he was on the edge of death because of his old age. And the sixth monk was a very ill monk. He was actually so weak with his sickness that no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the last monk, number seven, was what we call the useless monk. Every time he tried to chant, he would chant off key and lose his place. When he meditated, he wouldn't just go to sleep, he'd snore and disturb everybody else. He couldn't keep his robes on properly either. He was a useless monk, and I often mention every monastery has one. You can check out with Ajahn who's... There you are. So anyway, those are the seven monks. Meditating, may all beings be happy and well. And according to the story, a group of thieves, a gang of thieves, found these monks. They were in a cave in the jungle, meditating on loving kindness. They found this cave, and they thought, this would be a great hideout. so they could use this as their base, deep in the jungle, concealed, and they could go into the towns and villages around, rob, and then run back with their loot to the cave, store it there, and never get caught. So they thought this is going to be their headquarters, their hideout. But of course they thought, they've got to kill all these monks first of all. Otherwise that one of the monks would tell the authorities, and what use would it be of a hideout? So they decided to kill all of the monks. But the head monk, he was such a good talker. Like other head monks you might know. He's such a good talker, and he talked and argued, and eventually he came to a deal with these band of thieves. The band of thieves insisted on killing one of those monks as a warning for everyone else to keep quiet. And that's the best deal the head monk could make. All the rest could go free, but one monk had to die. And so the head monk had this terrible decision to make. Which monk would have to be sacrificed so everyone else could go free? Now, if you know the answer to this riddle, please be quiet. If you read the story or remember on the tape, shut up. Because some of you haven't heard this, and I want to see if you understand what the right answer was. So I'm going to ask you, if you were the head monk, who would you choose to die? Now here's the list again, so listen carefully. There was the head monk himself. Number two was his brother, he loved very much. Number three was his best friend, they'd grown up together. Number four was the enemy, who he didn't really like. Number five was an old monk, he'd lived so long anyway, he was about to die. The next monk was a very ill monk, who was actually next to death as well. Maybe that could put him out of his misery, who knows. And the last monk was a useless monk throughout his whole life and never made a positive contribution to anybody. So with those seven monks, those who haven't heard the story before, who do you think was sacrificed? Who did the head monk choose? Ah, come on. Make my day. Say something. Himself. Heard himself. Those of you who think he sacrificed himself, put your hand up. Okay. You are all wrong. Now that's the most common answer, that he sacrificed himself. And that's one of the reasons why I asked that question, just to bring it up, that most people think he sacrificed himself. And that's the wrong answer. So any other suggestions? Brother, enemy, no, that's wrong. Sorry? No, the old monk, no, that's wrong. The useless monk, he always gets a mention, useless monk. No. I'll stop the interrogation now, because the answer was the head monk couldn't choose. His love and care for his brother was no more, no less than the love he had for his best friend. He even loved his enemy exactly the same. As he cared for the old monk, the sick monk, and the useless monk, exactly equal. The door of his heart was open to all beings, without distinction. Undiscriminated loving kindness. He loved everybody equally. For the most important part of the story, he loved himself no more, no less than all the other monks. Because he cared for himself as much as all the other monks, no more, no less, he just could not choose. I love mentioning that story because even in Christianity, one of the great sayings of Jesus is to love your neighbor as yourself. Not more than yourself, certainly not less than yourself. To love your neighbor as yourself means to love yourself as your neighbor. No more, no less, absolutely equally. And why is it that when you tell this story, in modern countries, it's not just here in Australia, tell a story in England, in the United States, in Asia. Why is it that people always say, I think he sacrificed himself? It shows you have a lesser regard for yourself than you do for other people. But still, we don't care enough about ourselves. Which means, one of the reasons why, we don't have enough happiness, health and success which we should have. By caring for yourself, it's not at the expense of other people. It actually helps other people and contributes to human happiness. So, what happened? That head monk went and told the leader of the band of robbers, "I'm sorry, I cannot make a decision because I love all of the monks exactly equal, no more, no less, as I love myself as well." And when he explained why, and this is actually based on a true story, it's changed quite a lot from the story, but it's based on the true story of Adimuttatera. And the result of him telling that all of the thieves were so impressed and inspired that half of the thieves gave up their robbing and got proper jobs in the village, and the other half of the thieves, including the robber, head robber, became monks. What a lovely ending to the story. And that's actually what it said in the ending to Adimuttatera, when he was actually taken in by the thieves and was threatened with death. So you can actually see just why we tell this story, is that we don't care enough about ourselves. So, for your 2009 resolution, how about resolve to care about yourself? No more, no less than all the other beings in this world. Not at the expense of others, but give yourself an even share. So what does that mean? What that means is, just as you would forgive others when they do silly things, why can't you forgive yourself? Why is it when somebody else makes a mistake, I say forget it, don't worry about it. But when you do the same thing yourself, you feel guilty, you feel you need punishment, and thereby you sacrifice your own happiness. Why can't you really treat other people and yourself exactly the same way? So you don't get angry at other people. You don't get angry at yourself as well. Every time you do a stupid thing, every time you make a mistake, just let it go. Don't make a big thing of it. Forgive yourself. If you can do that, it's called caring for yourself. And this is one of the sayings of the Buddha. Anyone who acknowledges their faults, that's the first thing you've got to do. Not hide it. Not say you didn't make a mistake. Acknowledge it. Number two, forgive it. Forgiveness means loving yourself enough to trust yourself that you'll learn from that mistake, which is actually the third stage, to learn from it. The old AFL code, acknowledge, forgive, and learn. That's all we really need to do. And the Buddha actually said, that is growth in the spiritual path. That's how you actually do become better people. That's how your faults disappear. Not through punishment, by acknowledging, forgiving, and learning. So this is actually how we do love ourselves, how we care for ourselves. We care enough to acknowledge what we've done, forgive it, learn and move on. What a beautiful people you would be if you could do that. So 2008 has gone past. So all the faults which have happened, acknowledge them. Stupid things you've done, the silly things which have happened, acknowledge them. And now forgive them. And learn from them. That is called caring about yourself. And that is called growing. And this is actually what we mean by how to care for yourself so you can actually get to be more peaceful, happy, successful human beings in life. This is your New Year's resolution, the goal. And if you care for yourself that way, it's not about changing yourself, just acknowledging, forgiving, and learning. Because most people, I think all people, they want to grow. They don't want to stagnate in life. Whether it's in your workplace, whether it's your home, in your religion, or whatever you want to do, we all want to grow, become better human beings. That, I think, is inherent in all human beings. Whether it's acquiring more knowledge, more happiness, more experience. If you think experience is going to bring you more happiness, more peace, more wisdom. Especially peace of mind, is a wonderful goal to be able to achieve. So our goal should be those things. I say that those are the most important goals in life. You know, what I call that spiritual capital. Sure enough, like the stock market and stuff goes up and goes down. You don't have to worry about that. That's material capital. There's something which is also really important, social capital and spiritual capital. And the talks which I was giving while I was overseas a couple of weeks ago was all about, yeah, I mean, maybe material capital might go down, but there's more than that to life. More than the stock market, the other things, which is your social capital. Your social capital is your husband, your wife, your kids, your parents, your uncles, your aunts, your people who you grew up with, your friends as well. That's your social capital. And if you care for your social capital, very often economic problems don't really affect you. Even if you lose your job, you've got enough friends, enough relations who give you your safety net. And just, you know, in ancient times, before we had pensions and Medicare, it's your family and friends will look after you in times of difficulty. And that was always the basic underlying system of safety nets in our societies, your friends and relations. And if we can actually go back even to that, pensions, that'd be wonderful. If they're not there, it's not that important, because we've got our friends and relations to keep us together in difficult times. So it's the social safety net, what we call social capital. And also got the spiritual safety net. And that spiritual safety net, you know, is, well, things come and go. You get an understanding of wisdom about life. Stock markets go down and they go up again. You know, you get sort of difficulties in life, which we all go through from time to time. And then they sort of disappear. And then you get your highs in life. And then they disappear again. You have to go back down the bottom again. It's a cycle of existence, the ups and downs of life. When we got the spiritual capital, the spiritual understanding, like knowing how to care for ourselves and how to care for other people, then that spiritual capital is far more important than the material capital. That keeps us together. So you know, in times of difficulty, there are some people who are spiritually poor. They're the ones who commit suicide. They're the ones who go crazy. They're the ones who get into drugs and, you know, can't stay with another human being. The relationships all fall apart. But those who've got very strong spiritual capital, you know, because that's what they've built. They've cared for themselves. They've grown in peace, in kindness, in friendliness. Those who've got great spiritual capital, they've got nothing to be afraid of. Because that is really what's going to be your feather bed. Even if you've got no money, if you have friends, then you're a very rich person. Just like that wealthy person who had no friends. She was the one I was concerned about. Some of the poor people I've known, who've got lots of friends, they're very happy. Those people who have a great sense of self-worth, at peace with themselves, it doesn't matter what if they lose their job. They can find another one, because they've got this great sense of being at peace with themselves, self-confidence, if you like. You know what it's always like, that sometimes people who lose their job, they've got no spiritual capital, they lose their self-esteem as well. They think they're hopeless, they're terrible, they've lost their job, they're on the dust heap of life. But if you've got the spiritual capital, you know this is just part of life, it comes and goes. If you've got the spiritual capital, then you can always pick yourself up. You just go and seek another job. You come across as self-confident and you've got this incredible sense of inner strength, and of course you get employed. So it's a spiritual capital as well as a social capital. These are the things which are really important. So the job of setting a goal, good goals, useful goals, purposeful goals, is not just to build up the sense of caring for other people and caring for yourself, but to build up your social capital and your spiritual capital. And if you can do that, then the ups and downs of the market, the difficulties in the workforce, you know, the other things which happen to you in life, old age and sickness, you can literally take that in your stride. Just like monks do. I've got no money. I travel all over the world. You can do this because you've got lots and lots of friends. And I tell people when I go over to Malaysia last week, but going to Malaysia, actually I did get sick. I ate something which was wrong. It's actually very, very exciting. Because I vomited just after giving a talk. Finished the talk. I don't know if it was on the video. Make a nice video. So, my spiritual capital is that I never have to take any health insurance wherever I go. Because I had no health insurance when I was in Malaysia for a couple of weeks. As soon as I got sick, how many doctors and other people had so many medicines the next day? Oh, you've got to take this, actually, Bob. It stops you getting sick. Take this. Look, I'm already over it. It was only just something I ate. Nothing sort of terminal. But you get so many people look after you. That's actually why, as a monk, if I ever do feel a bit sick, I really hide it. I try and sort of don't let anybody know. Because if I did die, if I cough here, you get sort of about 10 or 11 boxes of cough medicine the next morning. And the trouble is, everybody says, I brought this specially for you, Ajahn Pom. You will drink it, won't you? And they won't go until I say yes. And the trouble with the monk, if I say yes, I have to keep those promises. So sometimes, if I'm sick, sometimes I'm given so much medicine, and when I've eaten or drank all that medicine, then I'm really sick. But anyway, it's just a small sort of little stomach irritation. Once out, it was okay. But that's what happens sometimes. You don't need even health insurance as a monk because you've got social and spiritual capital, which is far more important. So to sum up the talk this evening on New Year's Eve resolutions, make some resolutions, set some goals, but set some really useful goals. Goals which, number one, are achievable. And are really worthwhile. Forget about winning the lottery. Forget about the big house. Instead, have the beautiful family values. Forget about sort of getting rid of the cancer. Care for it instead. Care for the people you know and love. Don't try and change them. If somebody gets angry at you, don't get angry back. Try and find another way of settling the problems. Especially in your relationships, husbands and wife, there's other ways of dealing with the problems rather than just shouting at each other. So, care for the person you're committed to. And also care for yourself as well. You count as well. So make your New Year's resolution. See which ways you can care for yourself and other beings. That's something you can always do. Can't always change them, heal them, but you can always care for them, like a doctor can. And if you can do things like that, you understand what we mean by building spiritual capital and social capital. And in turbulent economic times, that's something which you can do, and which you know is worthwhile, and will bring you the security and safety which money promised you, but never supplied. So that's how to set worthwhile goals, Buddhist goals, for 2009. Thank you.